Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, October 5th.
Secrets have a special way about them. Moving to and fro among your friends. Somebody's watching you. Somebody's watching you. Somebody's watching you.
In our in-depth interview released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, we have a wide-ranging conversation with Colonel Anne Wright. She is such an impressive woman. She worked in the military as both an active duty and reservist. She then went to work for the State Department, where she served in a number of countries. And today she is an activist on so many fronts. And one of the organizations she is deeply involved with is Code Pink for Peace. As we spoke today, she had returned less than 24 hours from Pakistan, where she went with Medea Benjamin and others to meet with Pakistanis, including attorney Shahzad Akbar, about the impact of America's drone strikes on the civilian population in Pakistan. And we talked about a whole lot of different topics with Colonel Wright, and I invite you to download the full interview at peterbcollins.com. In this excerpt, she talks about one of the issues that she has been so passionate about over the last few years, trying to fight rape in the military. And some progress is being made. But in this conversation, she enumerates for us, this excerpt you're about to hear, she enumerates the dimensions of rape, and in particular, how men are too often the targets. Most people think of rape as something that is exclusive to females, but it is a crime in the military that applies to both sexes. Here is an excerpt from my conversation with Colonel Anne Wright.
Well, it appears from statistics that the VA, the Veterans Administration, has compiled that one in three women during the time they're with the U.S. military will be sexually assaulted or raped. I mean, it's horrific, horrific. And over the past 8 years, as we've gathered more and more information and more studies have been done on it, the information coming out has emboldened more women and men to come forward to actually report officially that, they've been raped or sexually assaulted. To the extent that now the Department of Defense itself is the one that's giving the estimate that some 19,000 people were probably sexually assaulted last year in the U.S. military. And as you mentioned, a smaller number of them, 3,200, actually reported, officially reported being sexually assaulted or raped. Of that number, 10% of those that came forward to report this were guys, were men. Mm. Who were sexually assaulted, not in homosexual rapes, but in what rape really is, which is a power over somebody else to humiliate, degrade them. And that, I think, is really the tip of the iceberg. I think if for men to come forward is really difficult. It's hard enough for a woman to come forward to talk about it, but for a guy to finally acknowledge that some other guy has sexually assaulted him is really... that's a tough thing for the guys to acknowledge, and for for over 300 of them to come forward to say that that's happened to them. It is getting enough publicity now that even Time magazine had on its cover rape of men in the military. Now, how do you stop that? It is of epidemic proportion. It really is affecting the good order and morale of the military forces. And it's through congressional help, and particularly Congresswoman Jackie Speier, who has for the last 25 weeks at the U.S. Congress, every week in the House of Representatives, she has been taking the floor of the House to talk about the issue of sexual assault in the military. And she has been one of the leaders in talking to the senior leadership of the Department of Defense, from the Secretary of Defense right on down to the heads of each of the military services, to say, what are you doing to stop this? And now the military services have had to come up with what they call the battle plans. Mm-hmm. Battle plans not for combat to go out and kill people, but battle plans of how do you stop criminal actions against members of your own military units. And this is where now we're starting to make some progress, where the chiefs of the military services are saying, we've got a problem. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. They have to recognize it, and that they have to say that this is, or they don't have to, but now they are saying that it is a leadership problem, and they're going to put responsibility back onto the leaders of units.
In our conversation with Colonel Wright, we talk about, as I mentioned, a whole range of issues, including when the U.S. will finally decide to get out of Afghanistan. And she responds to a report in today's New York Times that Hamid Karzai has accused the United States of playing a double game by fighting a war against Afghan insurgents rather than their backers in Pakistan. And when I asked Colonel Wright about this, she said, well, he does have a point. And she went into a very interesting explanation of the origins of the Pakistani Taliban and how it was essentially moved into Afghanistan in response to the Mujahideen, the so-called freedom fighters that the United States had inserted in Afghanistan to throw off the Soviet occupation back in the 1980s and lingering into the 1990s. And so you'll be able to hear a lot of her commentary. And she, of course, with a military and diplomatic background, now applied to her peace work, is a real hero to me and somebody who has a lot to offer in understanding the impacts of American foreign and military policies. The Iranians, we finally are seeing some coverage with, of course, immediate dismissals of a plan that they have put forward. They call it a 9-step plan to defuse the nuclear crisis with the West. Now, what rankles the West is that Iran wants first to see an end to the crippling sanctions that have been applied. And in our conversation with Colonel Wright, she talks about the impact on the Iranian currency, which has lost a third of its value just in the past week. And I have previously reported, based on the excellent work of journalist Gareth Porter, that the Iranians made an offer in Istanbul this summer to stop the enrichment of uranium at 20%, which is not weapons grade or anywhere near it, if the West would lift these sanctions. And that offer wasn't even reported in the corporate media in this country. So it's good to see that the New York Times, in a story byline to David Sanger of the Washington Bureau, that they do offer coverage of this Iranian proposal. And they do acknowledge it's based on a proposal made to European officials in July. But this is the first that American media has got around to reporting. Now, certainly there are many problems and thorny issues that need to be worked out. But this is something that is not even acknowledged by the Obama administration, and it would serve us well, particularly as Obama has been able to persuade the hawkish Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, to at least for now delay his threats for an attack, a military assault on Iran. The investigation of the events at the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, this past September 11th, has taken an interesting twist because the FBI has finally arrived there 3 weeks after the killing of our ambassador and three other individuals. And they were only there for 12 hours. And as I pointed out earlier this week, the Obama administration is press releasing furiously that they're going to go get the perpetrators. Yeah, well, wouldn't you want to investigate first and find out who they are and what they did before you go kill them with a drone strike? Well, finally, the FBI has made it to Benghazi. It's unclear if they plan to return after their 12-hour exploration of the site. But as it's reported, already looters, curiosity seekers, and reporters have been through the site. And that means that the evidence could be severely tainted, or some of it may have been removed. So this story continues as Daryl Issa, the Republican car alarm millionaire who runs the House Oversight and Investigations Committee, is holding special sessions while Congress is in recess to promote a political investigation of this. And for once, I have to say that it appears that ISA has something to chomp down on. And we don't know exactly what the Obama administration is hiding, but clearly their efforts to persuade us that this was simply a spontaneous attack by a crowd that was fueled up by the anti-Islamic video doesn't wash. Turkey's parliament has ratcheted up a threat against Syria. Now, Syrian forces have been firing what they consider to be errant shells that have crossed the border into Turkey, into a small town where five people were killed in a home a couple of days ago. And now, Turkey's parliament authorized further military action against Syria as Turkish forces fired a second round of artillery across the border. And this does threaten to escalate and expand the civil war beyond the borders of Syria. And as I've pointed out, the role of the Kurds, which is an oppressed minority in southern Turkey, also has populations in northern Syria and in northern Iraq. And their goal is a Kurdistan that unites the portions of their population divided across these three borders. And so the Turks have more than a passing interest in pacifying the border with Syria. And, of course, they're looking at the long-term picture of what happens in a power vacuum when Bashar al-Assad is, presumably, removed from power. Back here in the United States, we've heard over and over again about the Republican efforts to crack down on voter fraud, which does not exist. And now we are seeing criminal prosecution of Nathan Sproul, a guy, or is it Sproul, a guy we've been following since 2004. He is a Republican hatchet man, and he applies his hatchet to voter registration, either by helping purge voter rolls or by running registration drives that only file the applications for voter registration of Republicans. And they use various means. They will conduct a poll, and if you respond that you're pro-Republican, they'll offer to register you to vote. And if you're not, they don't. And if you're a Democrat or you file as a Democrat, often those applications just don't make it into the voter registration files. And again, I want to credit my friend Brad Friedman at bradblog.com, who has done incredible reporting on this, and the story is finally surfacing in the New York Times and other corporate media outlets. He deserves a lot of credit, and the mainstream media rarely, rarely grants that. And finally today, the New York Times ran a lengthy story in Friday's paper about a man that I have great suspicions of. His name is Mansour Arbabsiar. You probably don't remember, but in the summer of 2011, he was accused of hatching a plot in collusion with an alleged drug runner from Mexico, a member of a drug cartel, and their plot was that they were going to kill the Saudi ambassador to Washington. And this was revealed, and almost immediately, the accusations and the narrative from our government were treated as fact, not as charges, not as allegations yet to be proved in court. And Arbabsiar is a strange guy. He was born in Iran, moved to the United States, and became a used car salesman, apparently pretty successful at it, working in Texas. And as he racked up money and lived the American dream, he made frequent trips back to Iran. And the government, our government, says that he has confessed to the plot that they, claim that they broke up. And it all stinks. It just looks like another setup job. And now they have had a psychiatrist spend something like 32 hours in six sessions interrogating and, talking with this fellow, Arbabsiar. And why the information from his psychiatric interviews has been leaked to the New York Times is a very important question. Now, despite his alleged confession, he has pleaded not guilty. And his lawyers are now trying to use the psychiatric argument to suppress the confession or confessions that he has made. And this article is full of colorful anecdotes about how he loves the Bee Gees and he reads the New York Post every day while he's incarcerated at the Metropolitan Correctional Center in New York. But when you boil all this down, he appears to be another patsy. A guy who either was set up or was so incompetent that he created this plot where he was going to raise $1.5 million to pay, I guess, drug cartel members to kill the Saudi ambassador at a restaurant in Washington. And again, it is the way this story has been used and treated as fact when we have very little information. There are two pieces of circumstantial evidence that surfaced right after he was arrested, and they are the records of two wire transfers from Iran to a bank in New York for roughly $50,000 each. And no drug smuggler, no guy who is a real terrorist or a covert operative for the Iranian government, or anybody who is serious about covert behavior, would ever, you know, set up a wire transfer in the amount of $50,000. Everybody knows that from the war on some drugs, wire transfers are carefully monitored, particularly those that exceed $10,000. And I just want to raise these issues and ask you to watch the coverage, because it appears that they will take him to trial sometime in the next 6 months, and the issue of his confession and his mental state, I think, are significant. Because this is such a crazy-ass plot that you have to suspect that he's not all there. And the other possibility is that he is, as I say, just a patsy who has been set up and has no way, basically, to work himself out of this jam because he doesn't have any means or any other information to disprove the claims of our government. So keep an eye on Mansour J. Arbabsiar and this alleged plot that was reportedly busted up by our government. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Your feedback is welcome. Email me, peter@peterbcollins.com. Happy trails.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.